Welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 16th of October, 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live tonight at radioalbion.com, if you hadn't already worked that out. Well, I do have an apology to make. We don't have Dennis Wise with us tonight. He's been taken for the worse. He's a lot more ill than he was, so he really needs your prayers. I'm hoping to hear back from him sometime next week, but he is now being properly looked after by the specialists, so at least that is something positive. We do have a special guest with us tonight, somebody I was having some conversation with earlier this week about slavery, and he was saying that he has read a lot of the primary source documents written by the slave owners. Some of these books I've read myself, and it really enlightened me as to how they were really God-fearing men. They were good men. They weren't the bad men that they have been portrayed as in the 21st century. So I was very interested to hear about his research. He's got a page on archive full of all these documents and these books, which I really recommend people read. And he goes by the name of Isaiah. So Isaiah, thank you very much for coming on the show. How are you doing today anyway? You're muted.
Oh, sorry. I hit the button, but it disappeared before I touched it. Didn't realize it. Thanks for having me. I'm doing well.
Yeah, I was really interested to hear that you'd read some of these books, because I'm always recommending to people that they read them. They say, well, what book should I read? And I say, well, if you read the racial books, the early racial books in the 19th century from about 1850 onwards, you'll get a really good grasp of what these people were like. And what really struck me was that they were so God-fearing, real Christian men that lived Christian lives. And there's no way they are going to be mistreating anybody in their care. It doesn't matter what race they are, they're not going to be mistreating them, particularly not when you've got, say, 100 black slaves and you've got one white family there. You've got a husband and wife and their kids, and they're working on a plantation. You know, they're not going to chance mistreating these slaves, especially not if they've paid the equivalent of £10,000, I think they say today, was the equivalent for paying for these slaves. So that was the first thing that really, you know, the logic behind it isn't really there. And then I wanted to bring up one particular quote here as well, which gives us an idea of how these former masters actually cared for these slaves. And this comes from a book called The Truth About Lynching in the South, and I think it was written about 1900. Just after 1900. And this is a quote that I've actually written in a summary of this book, and it gives some facts and figures. The Negroes were not just well looked after, but were treated like adopted children in many cases. According to the Negro Yearbook of 1913, they had over $700 million worth of property and 15,961,506 acres of land between them. Not bad for someone who had only just been freed from supposed slavery, which by definition means not being allowed to own any property. Clearly the white man was not quite so wicked after all, and had ensured that the freed slaves were given ample resources with which to earn themselves a living. Unfortunately, they did not want to earn themselves a living, and as long as the Negro had enough food to eat that day, he was not interested in what might happen tomorrow. Much of his farmland had been gifted to him by his previous masters in the hopes that he would make a success of his newfound freedom, but within a short while that prime real estate was fast being turned into a wasteland. At the 1915 Negro Conference at the Tuskegee Institute, it was stated that 20,000 Negro farms had no cattle, 27,000 had no hogs, 200,000 had no poultry, 140,000 had no corn, 750,000 had no oats, 550,000 had no sweet potatoes, and on 200,000 farms there was no arable farming whatsoever. On top of this never-before-known in the history act of kindness to the freed slaves, the white man also paid for the Negro youths to be schooled and educated. In fact, the Negro himself only paid 15% of all the private school tuition fees for his own offspring, with the white man paying the rest. So the former owners really did their best to make sure that these slaves had a means of earning a living, only they weren't actually capable of doing that. And that is exactly what they were saying in these primary source documents. They were saying that the situation is that this slave is not capable of doing this on his own. This is why we provide the farmland for him. He does the work. We pay him, essentially. They had the equivalent of a pension. They had the equivalent of healthcare. They had a roof over their head. They had clothes. They had food. They had everything. And they were taught an education. And in return, they were expected to work on a farm. Now, why is that seen as such a terrible thing? We had white people that worked as slaves. They couldn't work on these farms because it was too hot. And it was considered that it was too hot to have white men working on these plantations. Why don't we put these Africans there? Because they're used to this temperature. It was never, let's oppress these people because we don't like the colour of their skin, which is the narrative of today. But I know you've been looking at a lot of this stuff, Isaiah. So, do you want to tell us about it and what you've learned from your research?
Yeah, you made a lot of points and a lot of things I could get into great detail about. The first point I want to make, and it's very important for people to understand this, is you cannot judge the past based on modern sensibilities. You have to let go of your view of the world and place yourselves in others' shoes and in the reality in the world that they lived in, and look at the facts that they had to deal with. Because there's things that we could know now that perhaps they didn't know then, or experiences we have now that they didn't have then. So that's the very first thing I want to start with. And people have to remember to do that when they're studying anything in history, that you cannot judge the past based on the present. If you do, you're going to miss the point. You're going to be uninformed. You're going to cause yourself to make false conclusions. So you made a lot of excellent points there, all of which were true. The number one issue with, so you got to look at different periods of time. First off, go back to the start. Why were the blacks taken here to begin with? You go back with the Portuguese were the original ones to start importing slaves into what were at the time called the West Indies, the Caribbean islands. And I think it was Cuba in particular, although it wasn't called Cuba at the time, where you had a Catholic priest named Las Casas brought in, I think he was Portuguese, brought in some African slaves, because one thing that we're not taught a lot in history today is that when the whites being all the European peoples that were coming here, the different ethnic groups of whites that you have. But anyway, they were coming here and finding the climate and the environment intolerable to their nature. And they were dying in droves right down the street. Actually, I was born in Williamsburg, Virginia, near the Jamestown settlement. When the people were settling here in Virginia, they were dying in droves. And this is pretty far north compared to the Caribbean and down south. And the farther south and the closer to the equator they got, the harder it was for whites to live in the environment, and nearly impossible for them to work in the tropical heat all day.
I think they had malaria and yellow fever and other things like that were really affecting them, whereas the blacks seemed to have a natural immunity to it. Am I right in thinking that?
Exactly. And the first thing they tried to do, was subsist on their own, and they weren't able to do it. So they started enslaving the natives that they were coming across. And they weren't making good slaves. And this is back in the 14 and early 1500s I'm talking about here. And so they started it. That's why they started importing the blacks. They proved to be very profitable, able to sustain the climate. Not only did it not kill them, but they functioned perfectly fine in it. It wasn't anything unnatural for them, and they weren't dying because of the climate. So more and more slaves started getting brought in. Then you fast forward, you got tons of history, and you get to the period that I like studying the most, which is the 1800s in the South, what we call the antebellum South, the pre-war South, and how slavery existed at that time. And it was not the exception either. If you look at slavery in general in the so-called New World, it was a situation where, by and large, and I'm always speaking in general terms, someone can always come at you and say, well, what about this? What about that? Where they'll point out examples, exceptions, where some slave was beaten to death, or some story of some oppression on a plantation somewhere where a farmer lost everything and split all these families up, and you know, abused some slaves because he had lost everything and was an alcoholic. People will point out these exceptions, but the argument is, and the argument that people in the Old South would often bring up is, you can find evil in all of man's institutions and relations. Where you look at marriage, where you have husbands that beat their wives to death, you have wives that abuse their children, and so on and so forth. You have all these evils within human institutions and relations, but that doesn't prove the institution or the relationship itself is evil. And that's what people today are made to believe, that slavery equals evil, freedom equals good, and there's no exceptions. It's completely black and white. Whereas the old mind, and based on their experience, slavery was an institution that God had created to take care of the poor and the incompetent. And all of their experience proved that blacks were incapable of freedom. They had no historical record. They had no history at all. But even based on what whites had discovered about them, is they had never created a civilization. They had invented nothing. They didn't understand freedom on their own. None of their societies were based in freedom other than savage freedom, you know, out in the jungle or something, where you have cannibalism and witchcraft and all these weird things going on. But anyway, my point is that all of their experience had shown that blacks not only did not comprehend freedom, but they were incapable of it. And under slavery in the New World, the blacks were not only far better off than they were in Africa, but they were prospering in great ways. They were making tons of progress. And an observation, which I know you're aware of, but a lot of people today probably aren't aware of, is something they noticed, is that blacks were very good at imitating the whites. That once they were migrated into white civilization, they adopted Christianity, they adopted the customs and the manners. And so long as they were around white civilized people, they tried to excel to that standard. And as soon as slavery was abolished in areas, and they had tons of examples of where in the East Indies, where slaves were freed, where you had mainly the British colonies started doing it first, where they were freeing the slaves. And in every single case, whether it's Jamaica, where it's Haiti, where they killed all the French people and so-called freed themselves there, and other experiments in different Caribbean islands where they abolished slavery, that everything went to hell afterwards. The production on the plantations fell by 90%+ within a short period of time. Crime went through the roof. They started returning to their savagism that they had, you know, naturally, obviously, inherently adopted while they were in Africa. It was just part of their nature to basically not provide for the future, not think of any civilized way of, hey, let's form a community here. Let's get this produce going. Let's build these farms. Let's create a civilization where we'll be as comfortable as we possibly can. Yeah, it's going to require some labor and some work to do this, but overall, it's going to be the best thing for us. They didn't think like that. What they would do when they got their freedom was, hey, we're free. Now we don't have to do anything. And we're in these tropical islands. We're in these places that provide us all the food and comfort that we need. It doesn't get cold to where we have to have these nice shelters. We can just put a little mud or straw hut together and eat the naturally growing food and sit around all day and not do anything. A perfect example of this is Haiti, where the French had built what was known as the paradise of the New World. It was per capita the richest colony of the New World. And the French had built this miraculous, like, paradise on earth. You read the old stories about Haiti and how revered it was, and how people from Europe and places in North America and South America too, a lot of rich people would travel to Haiti when it was still a French colony and under slavery, because the rumors of it were so magnificent. You got to see this place. It's so beautiful. It's so spectacular, and so on and so forth. Well, once the blacks rose up there and killed all the whites on the island and got their freedom, within less than 10 years, they had ruined it all. It had gone from the wealthiest per capita colony of the New World to completely impoverished, crime-ridden, like just horrible things going on there. And this is after there's no more whites there. You know, they got their freedom. And this is just one example of many. So going over to the South, which is where I've read most of the books I've read were written by Southerners. There's some Northerners as well have written books during that time, but mostly Southerners, where they had all this experience to look at. And not only just that foreign experience, but experience at home. In 1860, a year before the war started, you had over 200,000 freed blacks in the South, and 95%+ of those had done nothing with their freedom, but exactly what all the blacks had done beforehand. And then you had the North, where you had a little less than 200,000 freed blacks, and they were all living in ghettos, suffering from alcoholism, prostitution. It was a rampant situation where freed blacks would sell their children into slavery because slaves fetched so much money. They could live off of selling their children into slavery without having to do anything else for months at a time and just drink and do whatever they want. That was a problem. It was discussed and written about back then. Like, hey, this is what's going on. What do we have to prove that these people are going to be capable of freedom? Because every time they're set free, not only does it turn out bad for them, but it turns out bad for society in general. So they had absolutely no evidence provided available to them to encourage them to say, hey, yeah, these people are worthy of freedom. These people need to be set free. We're oppressing them by holding them as slaves. They have a natural right, you know, under the Declaration of Independence and so on and so forth. All men are created equal, which is another point, just to not to get too much on that. But that's another thing that people today, based on modern sensibilities, completely misunderstand, is that when that declaration was written, it was talking about all white men. And people said, well, it didn't say that. It said all men. Well, who were they talking to? And people today, because of modern sensibilities, will say, well, they were hypocrites because they wrote that. And then many of those men were slaveholders and they didn't free all their slaves. Well, they didn't free their slaves because they weren't talking about them when they wrote that. They were talking about white civilization, that all white men of adult age are created free and equal, and that no other man has an inherent right to rule over that man. You know, because they have, I know you know this from reading John Every's work, where we as white people have all the same sensibilities and moral nature within ourselves, with the exceptions, excluding the exceptions, but in general, and that it becomes a moral evil if we oppress our neighbor. And this goes back to biblical times, even in the Old Testament, where it gives rules in the Mosaic Law about not oppressing your brother, even if he sells himself into slavery. You treat him as a hired servant, not as a bond servant. But anyway, just to make the point, though, with the Declaration of Independence, they weren't hypocrites by writing that and not freeing their slaves, because they weren't talking about them. Because even at the founders' time, there were experiments done with black freedom, and it never turned out good. And so they understood the nature of blacks back then. And
can I just interject there? I don't think the blacks themselves, they weren't citizens. They weren't considered as men. They were considered
exactly.
Negroes.
Yeah, they weren't citizens.
They were Negroes. Not to say that Negroes aren't human or anything like that, but they were considered Negroes, and the white man was considered man. And that was the way it was. So when the Declaration of Independence was written, that's what it was talking about. And it was saying, when you have the white man in juxtaposition with the Negro, all the white men are equal to one another, the same as all the Negroes are equal to one another. But you couldn't say that if altogether the white man was equal to the Negro, because obviously he's different. He's a different subspecies, a completely different subspecies. So it doesn't make any sense. So the Declaration of Independence makes no sense at all if you include any other race into it. You have to look at the terminology that they were using at the time. So when they were talking about man, they were talking about the white man. And just to make another point there that I think I can add here, when you were saying there about how when they had the white masters, they would imitate the white masters, and this was something that they hadn't seen before, and the blacks were becoming Christians, and they were able to become educated and have some semblance of civilization when they were copying the whites. And I think we see the same thing today. They did have segregation, and the blacks were in their own schools, and they said, well, this isn't good enough. We have to have access to white children. So they started busing all the white children into these schools, and it almost became like a civil right of a black student to have a white student sat next to him. And they thought that that would raise up the standards because the blacks had such low educational standards. So they said, well, if we move in the white children and have mixed schools, then that will raise up his standards. And it's the same mentality as what we saw before, but they cover it up and they say, well, this is going to make them get better exam results. But in actual fact, what it is, it means that we're putting somebody there for them to imitate. So it hasn't changed. It's still exactly the same as it was 200 years ago. When you have them on their own, you get Haiti or you get Liberia, which don't forget Liberia was set up with the same democratic style as America, and the freed slaves were sent there. They had all the help they possibly could to maintain and manage their own country. And if you look at it now, it's all cannibal warlords, and it's a terrible place to live. Yet it had the best start out that it could possibly have. So it's not like white men have tried to oppress these people at all. They've really tried to help them. As you were saying, the white man has always helped out the poor and the people that couldn't look after themselves. And it was seen as that is what they were doing. These blacks, if they're left on their own, they would just revert to savagery. But we can put them to use on our farms, and we'll clothe them, we'll give them education, we'll feed them, we'll look after them, we'll make sure they haven't got lots of parasites and they're not ill. They had doctors for them. And that was the way that it was. None of it was about oppressing people. It was seen as a mutually beneficial system. Go on. Go ahead.
There's actually a great modern book I've read. It's one of the few modern books about slavery I read. I say modern. It's written in 1973 by two Harvard professors. It's called Time on the Cross. The subtitle is The Economics of American Negro Slavery. And it's a really excellent book because this researchers went just into the old records and said, hey, let's find all the old plantation records we can. And these are records about, because the plantations were meticulously run. They weren't just laissez-faire, hey, you know, let's get done what we can. No, they records were taken and kept. All the slaves, you know, who were on that plantation were named. And I mean, everything was meticulously tracked and recorded. So these men went into the old records and said, let's just see what the plantations in general were run like. Because slavery was a private institution. The government had nothing to do with it. There was no laws regulating slavery other than laws against abusing your slaves. Like if you killed one of your slaves, you beat them to death, you could be charged for murder. And it happened. There were slave owners back in the old South that went to prison for life for killing slaves, if it could be proven. Now, slaves weren't allowed to testify in court or be on a jury. And if slaves were the only ones witness to a crime, sometimes it was often hard to prove because they weren't allowed to give testimony or be a witness. And people say, well, see, that right there proves oppression. Well, again, put yourself in the time and understand why that was a law, why it was that way. Because if it wasn't that way, you could have masters being falsely accused all the time. You just get a few slaves to conspire against him, come together. One of them beat up or kill another slave, then say the master did it. They're the only witnesses to it. Next thing you know, you got an innocent man in prison, and that could happen all the time. So that was a protection against that.
Can I just add something else there? If I just add as well, that shows that, you know, again, these white masters were upstanding members of the community. They were seen as, well, they wouldn't lie. And I dare say you probably would have got instances where a white man would have stood up and said, I saw that white slave owner kill a slave. Which must have happened often. Yeah.
Here's a funny thing with what you're saying. It's something a lot of people don't know about today is that the old anti-slavery books, the most famous of which is a complete work of fiction, as most abolitionist writings were, even the ones that claim to be true, but Uncle Tom's Cabin. And then the lady who wrote that, Harriet Beecher Stowe, because she took a lot of heat after writing that book saying, hey, this is wrong. You've never been to the South. This is not the way it is. And so to validate her fictional novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, she wrote another book, which I'm not sure of the name of off the top of my head, but it's supposed to be a work of nonfiction. And it was recording what it was, a story after story. I don't know how many stories she collected. But what she did is she went in Southern newspapers and found over decades stories of cases of abuse where a slave had been beaten to death or mistreated in some way. And these were stories out of Southern newspapers where a crime was found out and the person was prosecuted or punished for the crime. And then she takes the stories and makes a book out of it and makes it appear like this is the way it is down there. It would be like me going to, you know, this is the example, Robert Louis Dabney, who was a Southern Presbyterian preacher, wrote a book after the war called A Defense of Virginia and Through Her, the South. And this was the common argument that Southerners used at the time and said it'd be like us going to the North and in particular state of New York, where wife beating and murder is common, very common, more so than other states in the Union. And I get all the stories out of the paper of all the husbands that beat their wives to death and then make a book out of it and say, look, see the merits, the institution of marriage is evil. Look at all these evil husbands killing their wives. So no, everybody knows that's the exception, that you have evil husbands who beat their wives to death, but that doesn't prove marriage is evil. And that's what they were doing. So yeah, it's just interesting you bring that up, because in most cases where people today think that slavery was this horrible, oppressive, tyrannical, just wicked system, they're only looking at the exceptions based on propaganda books to try to paint that perception that it was, that this is the general overall scope of how things are run, not the rare exception. I had a conversation with a guy one time where he said, oh, there's, I could go and find hundreds, perhaps even thousands of stories about slaves being abused. I said, okay, so what? In 1860, there was 4 million slaves in the South. You think it'd be hard to find a couple thousand cases a year of a slave being abused amongst 4 million? Of course there is. Find 4 million marriages, and I guarantee you're going to find a good chunk of men of those 4 million that have done horrible things to their wives or children or whatever. It's, that doesn't prove anything. You have to, with anything in life, look at the overall, not the exception. It's like how people read history and all they ever study is war and famine and pestilence and crime. And then they get this idea that all of human history is just this one continual struggle of nothing but misery and oppression, because they never study the 100 years between the war where it was peace and things were going good and they had some good kings and they had good laws. And then, but no, they skipped that 100 years and they go to the next tyrant that rose up and, you know, made things hell for 10 years or whatever. And they do the same thing with slavery, where they don't study the institution of slavery. They study the propaganda and the exceptions. And then they conclude, well, this is the way it was. Well, no, there's hundreds of books out there written by pro-slavery authors, like you said, who were good, God-fearing Christian men who ran large plantations, who had an intimate association and relationship with the institution, grew up around it all their lives, and said, no, this is not the way it is. I was reading a book recently, it's called, I can't remember what it's called, top of my head. I haven't finished reading it yet. I got on another book. But anyway, it's his story of his life growing up on a plantation. And this is post-war. This is in the 1890s. He wrote this book, but he grew up in Georgia on a plantation. And he said his whole childhood, growing up to adulthood, he couldn't remember one time ever hearing an adult cuss, use foul, what we would call foul language or cuss words. You think of that, how far from, and people say, oh, what's the big deal about cuss words? Well, it's showing what the nature of those people were like back then, their manners and the society that they had created and what it was like. So you think that something like cussing was even frowned upon to the point where a child growing up at that time in the world never heard adults use that sort of language, that they're out there beating their slaves to death and locking them in hot boxes in the middle of the sun for not working hard enough, and this other nonsense people believe that they see in movies and things where they, you know, just make it look like Southern people back in the 1860s during slavery times were these horrible, wicked, hellish people. And it's just not true. They were people just like us. They had the same sensibilities. And I would say even more so, I would say that they were in most cases probably even better than us, because we've been so degraded and brainwashed by the modern culture, which is so far fallen and debauched from any sort of moral principle that they believed in back then. So I would, from my experience, or not just my experience, but my research has shown that to be true, that in most ways they were better than us morally, but it's not, it doesn't appear that way because people are only focused on the negative things. One thing I like to point out to people is because slavery was mostly looked at as a Christian, God-ordained institution, not in a racial way, but in a way it was just part of the world that God had created, and that you have the poor you will have always with you, as the Lord said. And that in their society at that time, God had created the institution of slavery for the blacks because it was the best thing for them and society in general. And they looked at it in a scriptural way. Well, what are masters supposed to, what are we supposed to do with these people? Well, read Colossians 4:1, where it says, "Masters, give unto your servants that which is just and equal, knowing that you have a master in heaven." And that was preached in all the churches throughout the South. If someone was found out in the community to be a wicked master, abusing their slaves, overworking them, separating families, that was even another thing that was, it wasn't illegal. And there were cases where it had to happen, but it was looked at as something to avoid at all costs, try to keep families together because marriage was encouraged amongst the slaves. They didn't like promiscuous lifestyles amongst them, and their nature had shown them to be prone towards that, where they weren't really on their own prone to marriages and families and staying together as a family unit, but they saw the whites doing that. And so they would imitate that, and the masters encouraged that. They didn't forbid. Even slaves would have marriages on separate plantations, because that's another thing. They had freedom of locomotion in a lot of cases. They were working on the task system, not hourly. So on average, they estimate the slaves worked, depending on the season, between 6 and 9 hours a day on the task system. Some parts of the year, maybe a little more. Some parts of the year, maybe a little less than that. And there's ample evidence for that. Not just Southerners saying this, but even foreign observers that would come during in between harvest times, and they would write in their books, they'd go back to Europe and write a book about what they saw in the South, and they're like, yeah, them slaves are real lazy. They don't work very much. And they didn't realize, hey, I'd went in between a planting and harvest season, and there just wasn't a ton of work to be done at that time. And slaves worked on the task system, so they might have their jobs done in 4 or 6 hours that day, and they got the rest of the day to themselves. They had their own homes. They had their own plots of land to grow gardens on. They would even make money. They had their own little plot of land where they could plant their own vegetables or whatever they wanted to do, and they could sell it at market. There's hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of stories of slave narratives and just in books in general back at that time about slaves that had lots of money. There was one story in particular, I think it was Georgia and Mississippi, where it was a court case where this guy had robbed a slave lady for $300. And her master testified in court that she did have that money on her, and he knew she was very good with her money and often had lots of money because he at times had to borrow money from her when he was in a pinch. And, you know, it was in court where, and this is all, you know, documented historical record, where they're like, could a slave woman possibly have had $300? Because you're talking today's equivalent. This would have been, you know, $5,000-$10,000 or more. And, you know, here's a lady that's a slave that got robbed for $300 by a white man, I might add. And they're in court. Like, could she have possibly had that much money? They're like, absolutely, she did. She was very responsible with her money. But again, I've gotten in so many different directions. There's so many points I didn't finish making. But if you want to interject, I can keep going.
I'll just say again, you got an instance there of the white man sticking up for the slave. These were incredibly moral, God-fearing people that wanted to set a good example. Above all else, they tried to set a good example to these people. As you pointed out, they didn't have an institution of marriage naturally in Africa. That wasn't something that went on. They didn't pair bond for life. And that was something that was then encouraged by the slave masters. And they would allow them to have marriages on the plantation, and they would allow them to have their churches as well. This is where where these black churches originally sprang from, was allowing them to have them on these slave plantations. And when you think about it today, when we look around us, we have all these different products that we have that we can spend our money on. Before the age of the internet, you had all these shops that you could go to, and you could buy all different types of clothing, all different types of music if you wanted that, all different types of everything. Now, you go back 200 years ago, there wasn't that. There wasn't anywhere where you could go to spend your money, to go and spend your wages. And the slave master would provide provide everything. Like you said, he would provide the house, he would provide the garden, he would provide the clothing, he'd provide the heating, he'd provide the medicine, he'd provide the doctors if you needed the doctors, he'd provide the creche for the children. When the slave got too old to work, he would still be kept. So it was the equivalent of a pension. The slave would no longer have to work, but he'd still have his food, he'd still have his house, his garden, everything else. And when you think how much people spend just on their mortgage. I mean, some people are spending 50, 60% of their wages just paying for the roof above their heads. And all of that was covered by the slave master.
Yeah. The irony is today that by and large, most people, even whites, are less free than the slaves of the old South were, because they had no cares. They had no wants. There was no starvation. Parents didn't have to worry about what was going to happen to their kids. Children were kept in. They got to grow up and have childhood. Slaves often didn't start doing even light tasks, child slaves, until the age of 9. Meanwhile, in the North and all over Europe, you had children as young as 4 working in factories, and like little girls sewing with their mothers, knitting and stuff. These poor families that were having to work 16, 20 hours a day in some cases, depending. I mean, I could show, there's a really excellent book written by a Northern lady, which is falsely labeled as fiction today, but it's not. And anybody that reads the book knows that it's not. But it was written by an 18-year-old woman. Well, she wasn't 18 when she wrote the book. She was in her 20s. But when she was 18, she had grown up in Philadelphia and heard all these stories about how horrible slavery was in the South and how horrible Southern culture and people were. And when she turned 18, she was like, I got to see it for myself. I want to go see what the South is like for myself. And she had grown up in abolitionist Philadelphia. It was a hotbed of abolitionism. All the churches preaching it, tons of societies, and all the wealthy people supporting it. And so that's all you're going to get growing up there. And she was like, I want to go see it for myself. Because not many Northern people would even go to the South to see, because they believed it. And they didn't, they're like, I wouldn't even be able to handle going to that horrid place. So just stay in the North, read the abolitionist books and listen to the sermons and read the newspapers about how terrible the South is and believe it. And that's good enough. Well, that wasn't good enough for Caroline Rush. And she went down there and stayed for 3 years in the Deep South, because that's where most of the so-called oppression was worse. And she stayed for seven months at a time on various plantations over a period of 3 years. So she could really get to learn the workings of them. This is a Northern lady that grew up an abolitionist, believing everything. And she wrote a book called Slavery and Its Contrast, the North and South, Slavery and Its Contrast, A Tale of Real Life. And that book is absolutely heart-wrenching and a must-read for anyone that wants to learn about this topic, because of the perspective it's written from and who it was written by and what she says in that book. The book actually focuses mostly on her experience in the North with the poor people and how things were in the North. And she concluded, based on her 3 years she spent in the South, that God had never planted a more beautiful culture of people on the face of the earth than the Southern people. And that what she had been made to believe slavery was not at all. And that there was a real slavery that existed in the North that was far worse than anything she had ever witnessed in the South. And she tells some of the most heart-wrenching stories about things she witnessed every day in Philadelphia, because she was a Christian lady and she ministered to the poor in the community. And she has some really heart-wrenching stories. I cried more than once reading the book. And I actually I'm the only person that's ever left a review of that book on Amazon. And I put it simply is that it's a story about the hypocrisy of man, where you had the people, the abolitionists in the North in England and France, but mainly in the North in England, pointing the finger at the South while they had far worse oppression and things that they should have been dealing with in their own communities, in their own countries, and it completely ignoring that and pointing the finger at phantoms in a place they had no business in. And
can I just point out there that some of the really, I'll just point out there some of the things that these children had to do. They had to go up, white children had to go up chimneys. They had to be chimney sweeps. They had to run in between the, in the factories, the clacking machine work, the spinning jennies.
There's children run working underneath in mines in England.
Yeah, they would lose limbs. They would lose parts of their body. I mean, they would die at an early age. And while all this was going on, you had people in Parliament complaining about the treatment of the poor Negroes over in America. Whilst in England, you had all this going on.
It was a fantasy. It wasn't even going on in the South. That's the whole thing that's crazy about it. And that would bring me into a whole nother topic, which we probably wouldn't even have time to get into today, maybe another day if you want to have me on. But it was a conspiracy against the South. There was white civilization after, I would say, conservative Christian white civilization fell in the 1800s. And the South was the last and the most authentic of those conservative white Christian civilizations to exist. And no infiltration would work against her. There was no isms in the South. They were extremely conservative and traditional. They believed in natural aristocracy and authority. They clung to their Bibles and their guns, you know, to put it in a modern way. They were a pretty militaristic society. They believed in, you know, the conquest of the white man and that God had given him the new world to civilize. And, you know, they believed in that thing. And that's why a lot of Southerners were very, they were largely responsible for moving out west. But anyway,
What about the abolitionists?
I kind of lost my train of thought on that, I was making. Oh, yeah, but there was a conspiracy. Just to finish this point real quick, we don't have to get into detail about it. But based on my study, and there's a book I want to recommend based on this, and everyone must read this book. If there's one book that you must read to really understand some of the things I've brought up here, it's a book called, hang on, I'll put the note down real quick. It's called The South Vindicated Against the Treason and Fanaticism of the Northern Abolitionists by William Drayton. It was written in 1836 or published in 1836. If you want an idea what was going on and the conspiracy that took place, and slavery was used as the mechanism to overthrow the so-called American experiment, because the South had held on to the principles of which America was founded on with the founders. And she had not strayed away from those principles pretty much at all. If anything, she had become more conservative than the founders were, less liberal in a way of, it's hard to put into words, but more rationalistic, more Christian, more, hey, this is the natural order. Yeah, certain ideals are nice. These lofty ideas about different things of equality and freedom, but we're pragmatic. We're not iconoclast. We don't want to overthrow all existing order based on some radical ideal we hold on to. Principles are important, but we have to think about the order and the best welfare for society. And so these conservative principles dominated the South, and it became very different from any other place on earth. Extremely, I can't stress that point enough, how different and how conservative and Christian the old South was during slavery times. And my personal opinion, and there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, I mean, I can't absolutely prove this because I would have to be able to prove the intent that other people had. But my personal opinion is that there was a direct conspiracy against the South to overthrow it. And that slavery was merely used as the issue to bring that about.
Well, what were the abolitionists like then? Because you've likened them to Jacobins and anarchists and communists, and this was like quite some time before then, I thought. So what were the abolitionists?
Well, they're like after the Jacobins, and the Jacobins were the abolitionists in France. You know, a lot of people don't understand this. The Haiti Revolution, where the blacks rose up and killed all the whites, was at the same time as the French Revolution, and the Haitian Revolution started in France. And what originally happened there was you had French politicians saying, hey, this is wrong. We can't be oppressing these poor slaves like this. We have to free them. And it started off with giving mulattoes citizenship and equality with the whites in Haiti, which was vehemently resisted. And the mulattoes far outnumbered, I think it was around 80,000 of them, as opposed to about 40,000 whites that lived in Haiti at that time. And the people in Haiti, they're being, because they're a French colony, the French government's legislating on their behalf. And they're like, whoa, wait a minute. You can't do this. This, you're going to get us all killed over here or just unravel what we've established. Well, they didn't win out. The French government got overthrown during the French Revolution. And then those Jacobins, those radicals, started legislating for Haiti. And they're the ones that are directly, the abolitionists have so much blood on their hands. They are directly responsible for the slaughter of all the white women and children and men, obviously, on the Haitian island. And not just there, but all sorts of other atrocities. And even to this day, the world is suffering from abolitionism in the 1800s. You look at the American South and America in general, where we have a huge black population, where all the worst places in America are these black neighborhoods. And I've actually spoke to blacks that have moved out of those places and move into suburbs and wherever to get away from that. And they won't go to them. They're terrified to go into these black neighborhoods of how bad they are. And these things are a direct result of abolitionism. But you had a question. Oh, yeah. So what were the abolitionists like? They were basically communists. You look at their own writings, and you can't group them all together into one group, because you had like Quaker abolitionists who were devout Christian people who just had an idea of it's not in the Christian spirit to be ruling over someone else, to own them as a slave. And we don't see how that computes with the teachings of Christ. So we're against slavery. And that would, you could categorize the Quakers in that regard. They were still traditional Christians by and large, and they were against slavery. You know, the Amish would have fit into that category, although the Amish weren't political and didn't really speak about things, get involved in all that, because they were like, that's just the world. We want nothing to do with it. Then you had the different fanatical groups, which were the majority of the abolitionists, who were very idealistic, progressive fanatics. And the reason I recommended that book, The South, this will give you a great idea of what the fanatical abolitionists were like. The South Vindicated Against the Treason and Fanaticism of Northern Abolitionists by William Drayton. Everyone that's interested in this topic, everyone is interested in history and wants to understand how we got to where we are today, needs to read that book. And you'll learn in that book that a lot of what you're seeing going on today with the progressive, so-called progressive leftist movements that are clearly communist, is the exact same tactics were used against the South with the issue of slavery back then. I mean, identical to a T. To give you one example, the Northern abolitionists would print out hundreds of thousands of tracts in the North calling for slaves to rise up and murder all the whites, literally rise up in revolution against the whites in the South and kill them. And they would spread this propaganda all throughout the South. That is where a lot of the laws that came from, it's not where a lot of them, where all of the laws that came from disallowing slaves to be able to be taught to read or write, or read in particular. Obviously, you're not going to be able to write if you can't read, but it's because of that. The Nat Turner Rebellion in 1831 was caused by abolitionists, where you had abolitionists going into the eastern shore of Virginia, got a hold of some slaves, filled their heads with all these idealistic fairy tale ideas of freedom and how they deserve this freedom, and their masters are oppressing them and they're violating the laws of God. They would fill their head with all these dogmatic ideas. And then, you know, you get a reaction from it. It'd be like teaching a child that their parents are oppressing them and they need to rise up and kill them. And the children rise up and kill their parents, but they're still just children and they don't know how to take care of themselves. So what do you do now? But anyway, the Nat Turner Rebellion was caused by that. And you had 60 men, women, and children, including infants still in their baby carriages or cribs, murdered with machetes and hatchets by these slaves. And it went on for 2 or 3 days. And finally, that was put down by the local militia, the white men in the community. And Nat Turner even admitted, because they wanted to know after they got him, they peacefully caught Nat Turner without having to kill him. And he faced trial and then he was executed. He was hung for his crimes. But they asked him, why did you do this? Was your master oppressing you? You know, what caused this? And he's like, no, my master was good to me. He's like, he never, you know, beat us. He never did anything wrong to us. But you know, we were told we deserve freedom. And so we had to rise up and kill our oppressors. And so this is why laws started being passed, even though they were not ever enforced. No one ever went to jail for teaching his slaves to read. But it was just one of those things where a law gets put on the books and hopefully people will obey it. If they don't, there's no way to enforce it. I mean, Stonewall Jackson even had a school for black slave children in Lexington, Virginia, back before the war. And by Virginia code statutes law, you still couldn't teach slaves to read. And here's Stonewall Jackson, you know, teaching black slave children to read their Bibles.
I think just let me add there about you're saying there about they weren't actually able to enforce it. I mean, this is one of the problems. Once all this started, they didn't have the legal systems in place. And a lot of these farms were way out, miles away from the nearest city, which had a courthouse in it. So if you did have like a slave rebellion that started, it needed to be put down straight away. And this was the origin of these lynchings that started happening. And whites were lynched as well. It was restorative justice that needed to be seen to be done to prevent there being more crimes. And it only came exactly about after these abolitionists had started winding everything up and tampering with the slaves and starting up these rebellions. And so they needed to be a punishment, and the slaves needed to see you will be severely punished if you rape the family and murder the family that were looking after you. You will be severely punished. So that was the cause of this. And they couldn't wait until the equivalent of the police got there, or when they took them to the courthouse in the city. And they did have trials. I mean, the villagers would be there and they'd have a trial, and they would have a semblance of justice there. It wasn't just, you know, we'll just kill the guy for this.
Oh, no, they absolutely had a trial. Order. The Old South was was all about law and order and fairness and justice for all, that all men are equal under the law. I mean, that's a whole nother subject in itself that could tie into slavery, but it just was old Southern culture in general. But yeah, there was a point you brought up there that I wanted to touch on, and I lost it. But man, I wish I could remember, because it was tied into what you were just talking about. Oh yeah. So another thing, just to prove what the abolitionists were like, and this is something a lot of Southerners back then brought up and said, look, you know, if you people are honest about your principles and your Christianity and your fairness and what you believe, then why aren't you trying to help us? If you think slavery is so evil, then how come everything you're doing is making the situation worse? If you cared for these people, then why aren't you spending your millions? Because see, this is another thing, just like we see with the radical movement of today being financed by all these wealthy oligarchs. It was the same thing with abolitionism back then, where it was a rich man's movement in the North and in Europe. It was being financed with millions and millions of dollars. And they're spending all this money to print out tracts and to have committees and institutions and anti-slavery organizations and missions and all this different stuff. And they're not spending any of that money to try to buy any of the slaves and redeem them. They're not spending any of that money to try to make the institution better for the slaves in the South, to go down there as friends and say, hey, we're Christians too. What can we do to help y'all with this situation that you inherited? That's another thing. The Southerners in the 1860s did not create the institution of slavery. They inherited it from their ancestors. So you imagine being born into the world, as we all are even today, with the evils that exist around us. And you're like, yeah, this sucks. We don't like this situation. How can we make the best of it? Because we can't obviously overthrow it or do away with it in one fell swoop, but we can make the best of the cards that were dealt to us. But the abolitionists weren't doing that. They were doing everything the exact opposite of what you would be doing if you had the best interests of your country, of society, and of the blacks and the whites in mind. If you had all those things in mind, the best interest of all those things in mind, you were doing the exact opposite to prove that. And that's what the abolitionists were doing. Sadly, the abolitionists won the culture war in the 1800s. And so everyone today is trained by abolitionist rhetoric and propaganda. So people have a complete false view of that whole history of what slavery was like, what the pro-slavery argument was. That's why, I mean, I've still to this day am very studiously studying the pro-slavery writings, because there's so many of them, and I haven't kept exact number, but I know I've read more than 20, maybe 30 of these old pro-slavery books. and I have over 100 of them.
Archive.org,
but I still read it because I've learned so much from it. And there's not just about the institution of slavery, but fundamental principles, philosophical arguments about that are rational, that affect us even to this day, because people today are way too idealistic. They see the world through rose-colored glasses. And I'm not saying ideals are bad, but we have to be pragmatic with those ideals. And if our ideals would cause the downfall of society and the suffering of millions for the sake of an ideal that maybe you might see some positive results for in 500 years from now, and say, well, it's worth it then. People are going to have to suffer for the next 500 years so my ideal can win the day. No, that's fanaticism. And that's what the abolitionists were like. They saw the ideal as the ultimate principle to live by, and to hell with the consequences. And they even wrote that way, whereas Southerners would say, okay, let's say you get your way and all these people are freed suddenly. What are you going to do with them? They don't know what freedom's like. They're not capable of it. All experience has proven they don't understand what it is. Every time they're given their freedom, it turns out worse for themselves and for society in general. So what is your plan? And they're like, we don't care. We don't have a plan. They just have to be freed. Slavery is evil. They must be freed and let the consequences be what they may. And that's what the abolitionists were like. And that's foolish.
Well, that's the same as what's going on today, isn't it, with anarchists and communists. Exactly. They've got no plan of what to build. They just want to tear down. And it's hard to find this stuff. When you look on Google Images, I was looking on Google Images, and I think I put in pro-slavery propaganda. One or two pictures is all you come up with. Everything else is anti-slavery. And it's very hard to find this stuff. But if you go on archive.org, that is an absolute treasure trove of this, and it's all primary source documents. You're talking stuff that's written in the 1800s, the 1830s. It's all written at the time this was going on, and that should hold more weight than anything that's being written today about it. And yet people will refer to films that they've seen, movies that they've seen. They'll go to the slavery museum in particular, which comes out, which shows you this ship and says all these slaves were head to toe on this ship. And that's a lie. There was a big gap in the middle of it. More of the crew actually died than the cargo themselves. Why? We're told that they just threw these black children over the side of the boat. It's absolute nonsense. Why would you throw your cargo over the side of the boat? You know, they would rather the crew went over first before the cargo, because of the cost of it. And it was in their best interest to ensure that the cargo got there safely and healthy. And it was the crew that really suffered on these boats. And we're not told anything about that.
John H. Van Every makes that point, because he's one of the few writers. He was actually from New York and I don't think he ever owned slaves. But anyway, you know, John H. Van Every is, and he was one of the few pro-slavery writers you'll find that actually argued positively for even the slave trade. Because that's another thing you got to distinguish between the slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade that was, you know, going all over the New World, South America, so on and so forth. And then you have the domestic slave trade within the countries where it existed, where most people back then, even the pro-slavery writers, would admit or concluded, yeah, the slave trade was evil, but the domestic slave trade has nothing to do with that. John H. Van Every actually took it farther, where he said, no, the slave trade, I believe, was God's purpose for the black race to finally civilize them and to Christianize them and make them useful for the world. And one of the arguments he uses is that when the slave trade was legal, the amount of people who died in transport was 10% or less. Which people today are like, oh, that's horrible. Well, you got to understand, back then it was a much more harsh world, and that's probably the same numbers for crew and people at that time, you know, making that long journey. Right, whereas after the slave trade was banned, it became 40% and more, that all these harsh practices, you had to hide the slaves on the ships. That's when piracy became a thing, and that's when the true horror of the slave trade became a thing as well, is after it was banned. And he was like, we need to make the slave trade legal again, because the slave trade being illegal is actually having negative effects and is producing the evils that everyone's writing about now.
When I looked up Edward Colston from the statue that was pulled down over here in Brittany in Bristol, and I was looking into his connections with the slave trade, that's when I noticed that the number of crew that they had listed for actually dying was more than the slaves. And the slave trade is obviously worse now, but they are going on now in Africa. There's a huge slave industry that's still going on in Africa, and yet they will only talk about the horrible, mean southern whites that made the lives of the blacks a hell of a lot better than they were in Africa. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Isaiah. I've really enjoyed that. I'm sure the listeners have as well. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.